We are looking at different positions that are taken on marriage and divorce. These are things that you would hear possibly in a Bible class or a sermon in various places. And so it's good for us to be prepared to examine what we hear, 1 Thessalonians 5, to test the scriptures to see if the things are so, Acts 17, 11, or to test the spirits, 1 John 4 and 1. And so by studying God's word and studying what different views are held on this important topic, it causes us to go back and test the things we learn and see if they help us in ascertaining truth. So we've got two positions we're going to look at tonight. I've told you that these various positions are taught by good men. This one, first one, is taught by a man who, in fact, he wrote a book on dealing with Bible questions. It had a lot of good material in it. The man held meetings all across the brotherhood, a good preacher. But on this particular point, I believe he's wrong. So you'll have to make up your own mind. But anyway, here is the position that he defended and held. And I simply chose to call it the divine prerogative. So we have a brief description of it here. Matthew 5:32 grants a divine prerogative to put away your mate if they committed fornication. Is that correct? Yes, that's correct. If your mate puts you away for some other reason, it is by human authority and not recognized by God. Therefore, you are still married in God's eyes. Later, if your mate commits fornication, you may now exercise your divine prerogative and put your mate away. Throughout the course of our studies, we've talked about this little phrase, married in God's eyes. And this is one of the reasons we want to stress it, because it's used to uphold positions like this one that are false. So in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 32, everyone who divorces his wife, except for the cause of unchastity or fornication, makes her commit adultery. So Jesus does give the divine prerogative to someone to put away their wives for the cause of unchastity or fornication. So our question is the everyone, note verse 32, everyone, or your version may say whosoever or whoever, in the first part of the verse, is that person married or divorced? It's obviously a married person, not a person who has been divorced. How do you know it's a married person in the first part of the verse?
They say who divorces.
Because they can divorce. If you're not married, there's nothing to divorce. Divorce is the severance of the relationship. So the fact that this person, in the first part of the verse, can divorce their wife either by divine authority because of fornication or without divine authority for some other reason indicates that Jesus has in view a married person, not a person who was married but has not been married for 5 months or 5 years or 20 years. This position says that if that person put you away for some other reason, in other words, you didn't put them away for fornication, you still have that divine prerogative to put away your mate for fornication. And what that other person does cannot take away your divine prerogative. But if the person, if you're divorced, what happens to your prerogative? It's gone. You don't have it. You're not married. Putting away is for a married person. And so the position says, well, you still are in God's eyes. Where's the verse that teaches when a divorce takes place, you're still married in God's eyes? There is none. Now, in Romans chapter 7, this may be used. Here's a woman who, verse 3, is joined to another man or married to another man. So she commits adultery. But if you're arguing this position, you might say, yes, but she's still married to the first husband, because it says, while her husband is living. So he's still her husband. She's still married in God's eyes. Is the fact that he's called a husband prove that they're married?
No.
Can you think of an Old Testament case where a person is called a husband or wife, where it's clear that they are not their husband or wife any longer? Uriah and Bathsheba. This is a common figure of speech. In John 9, they talked about the blind man, but he wasn't blind anymore. He was a blind man. And so we use past circumstances to describe certain things. We illustrated this in our last class with Elizabeth bearing her husband, but he wasn't her husband anymore. Past relationship. And so that doesn't prove it. Then the second thing here in Romans 7, but it says she's an adulteress, and the reason is she's still bound by law to her husband. So there it is. She's still married to him in God's eyes because she's still bound by law to him. What's the problem with that reasoning?
Bound doesn't mean married.
That's right. Bound by law does not mean married. Those are not equivalents. This is a legal bond. What is a marriage? Is it a legal bond?
Relationship.
It's a relationship. It can be a holy relationship. It can be an unholy relationship. In Matthew 5:32, where we started, when a person divorces his wife for some other reason than unchastity, what did Jesus say that he does to the second woman? What action?
Marries
her. An action may be recognized as reality, as such, in other words, divorce, without divine approval. Who is this person married to, the second woman? Does God approve? No. Doesn't approve. And so this idea of still married in God's eyes is simply not biblical. All right, in 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 11, this is a good verse to remember here. So this position says, your mate divorces you, you didn't want them to, so you're still married in God's eyes. You have that divine prerogative. And if 6 months later they give into the temptation of the flesh and commit fornication, now you exercise your divine prerogative and divorce them. But here in 1 Corinthians 7:11, a woman leaves. Now, leaves, what's a synonym for leaves?
Divorce.
Divorces. Where did Jesus use the same word in a discussion about divorce? Matthew 19. There it's translated separate. And the question was about divorcing. But even if you don't know about Matthew 19, it's clear it's divorce. Why? Unmarried. So if she was married and she's now not married to that person who's still alive, how do you describe her? Divorced. The word divorce doesn't occur, but that verb leave is talking about divorce. She is now unmarried. She's not still married in God's eyes. The relationship has been severed. And so that's helpful in that regard.
Steve.
Heard somebody say something. Where at?
So if someone leaves their spouse, does that mean they divorce that spouse?
Not necessarily. You leave your spouse every week. Don't you? You don't? She goes to work with you?
Just not in her physical proximity, but I haven't left her.
Y'all are in the same place?
Not in the same place.
No, you leave her. Leaving is not necessarily divorce. In the first part of this chapter, in chapter 7, verse 5, there's a leaving. Is it divorce? Look at verse 5. It's a separation. What's the difference in verse 5 and verse 11?
By agreement.
One is by agreement. And two is what? For a period. It's not a severance of the covenant of marriage. Verse 11 is, we're through. We're severing the relationship. So no, Josh, I would not say that every time a person leaves their mate, they are divorcing them. If they're severing the covenant, yes. A person may have a job. Michael leaves his wife for 2 weeks sometimes. But it's not a severance of their relationship. They're separated when he's out on a rig somewhere. But that's not divorce. Definition of terms is critical. That's why we started with the term marriage. Marriage is a relationship. Not legal papers. A relationship. That's dependent on two things, covenant and sexual union. And so, clearly when she leaves here, it is divorce because the text says she is unmarried. So the opposite of leaving him in this context, if you go on and read verse 12 through 15, what's the opposite of leaving him? The little two-word phrase. Live with. Look, verse 12. She consents to live with. That's the opposite of leaving. Same thing in verse 13. He consents to live with. So when you get to verse 15, if the unbelieving one leaves, let him leave. That's divorce. You're not under bondage to live with. You don't have to chase them all over the country. You don't have to hog tie them and get them back. So, if they leave, if they divorce you, there's nothing you can do about that. You're not demanded by God to force them to stay and live with you. Okay? The second position we're looking at Matthew chapter 19. Yes, sir, go right ahead.
So, if someone commits adultery, haven't they left their spouse?
No.
Didn't they sever the agreement?
No. No, they didn't sever the relationship of husband and wife. Now, that's an option. The other party can put them away if they wish. But people have affairs with their mate, and they're not intending to sever the relationship against their, you know, they have a relationship with somebody at work or a friend. They're not intending to sever the relationship of husband and wife. They've just been unfaithful. They've sinned. They've violated their covenant, but they still have that covenant between them. They violated it. They promised when they married not to do that. Let me ask you this. You say, well, they violated the covenant, so they're not married. Did they covenant to honor and cherish their mate? You did, didn't you? So if you do not honor and cherish Tammy, y'all not married anymore? No more covenant? No, if adultery does it, so does that. The adultery is a sexual act. Now, if it severs the marriage, can the innocent party put them away? They can't. And yet Jesus says the innocent party can put them away. So the marriage has not been severed. They committed adultery. Now the innocent party can divorce them, but they can't divorce them if the marriage is broken. They're already divorced.
It seems like the key is the live with part. If they've chosen not to live with, if one spouse says, I'm choosing not to live with you anymore.
If they choose not to live with you, sever the marriage, that's one thing. But people commit adultery, and they're not intending to quit living with their mate. Either they succumb to the flesh, or they're having an affair on the side. They want to keep coming home and spending time with the person they pledged to. It's a shame, but that happens all the time. When I worked at the Gulf Oil Refinery, young man with other young men, they weren't at all ashamed to talk about their affairs, but it wasn't that they were severing their marriage. Didn't want to go home and live with the woman they pledged to. Now, they didn't want her going out and having an affair. Kind of two-way road there. But anyway, I know that it doesn't sever the marriage, because if it does, you can't divorce your wife for adultery. You're already divorced. And that's the idea that we talked about in our last class. Remember, marriage is a relationship based on a covenant and sexual consummation. Because you violate the covenant doesn't end the covenant. Any more so that if you get mad and you say things to your wife you ought not say, and you did not cherish her and honor her like you pledged, she'll say, that's it, buddy, we're divorced. No, that didn't mean you're divorced. But you violated your covenant. Yes, you did. But that doesn't mean the covenant is not still between y'all. You violated it. So, do you ever violate the covenant you made with God? Does that mean there's no relationship between you and God when that happens? No, it doesn't. Now, you have the choice to continue in that course and sever that relationship, or if you continue, God may sever that relationship. But I hope that when I sin, that doesn't sever my relationship with God. My goodness. All right.
Steve?
Yes, sir.
Executed, made it's not that, as you're saying, it's not the act of adultery that
no.
produces divorce. The other mate has to execute it. They have to divorce the other person.
In the Old Testament, same was true. A man found his wife guilty of fornication. Now what can he do? Can he divorce her? Yes. But how could he do that if the marriage is severed? Marriage relationship, remember that. It's not a matter of in God's eyes, whether it's holy or unholy, it's in God's eyes, if the relationship is still there, based on a covenant to live together as husband and wife. That's what marriage is. Okay, Matthew 19:9. I don't sit up at night dreaming up these positions. These are positions that are taught, and I believe oftentimes taught by sincere people. I just happen to think they're wrong. All right, so here's one. It says Matthew 19:9 only allows the divorced. Although the Matthew 19:9 only allows the person who divorced their mate for fornication to remarry without sin, so they recognize that part of it. Then they go on to say, the reason Jesus made that allowance is for the protection of the innocent. So, see that little so there? It's the thought process. Remember when we read Romans 7, what's the first three verses, of first three words of verse 3? So then if. All right. So this person says, Jesus made that allowance for the protection of the innocent. So the sense of the passage, they agree the text doesn't say it. See, they've already allowed that. The sense of the passage would justify the innocent person divorced by a fornicator to remarry. That way it protects them. So this fornicator injured them. And so divorced them. And so they didn't divorce the fornicator. The fornicator divorced them. Well, boy, that leaves them in a bad shape. It does. Well, Jesus was trying to protect the innocent. That's the idea. So therefore, the innocent can now put away their mate and remarry. Look, the sense of a passage. How do you gather the sense of a passage? Well, what the text says. Not by what you feel in your heart, not by what you think is right or wrong, by what the text says. So, let's start with Matthew 5. We'll come back to Matthew 19. Well, if you got your Bible open at Matthew 19, since we're talking about it already, let's just start there. What is the topic of discussion between Jesus and the Pharisees? Somebody ask you, what is the topic of this discussion? What would you say it is? Based on the text. Divorce. Look at verse 3. Can I divorce my wife? Look at verse 6. No, you can't separate from her. That is, you can't divorce her. No. But verse 7. Moses allowed us to divorce. Verse 8. He allowed you to divorce your wives because of the hardness of your heart. Verse 9, if you divorce your wife for any other reason than fornication, you commit adultery. It's divorce throughout. Is there anything in the text about protecting the innocent? Nothing. You have to read that in. There's two words, exegesis and eisegesis. Got a sign right up there. You got a sign right up there. It says exit. What does that mean? The way out. Exegesis. You take the meaning that's in the text and bring it out. You try to understand what's in the text. Let me ask you something. If a person is standing out there in the grass, can they exit this building? No. No, they can't. Exegesis has to, The meaning has to be in the text. Eisegesis is reading into the text something that's not there. Beware of that. So, when you study your Bible, is it in the text? All right, so we know this context is about divorce. Let's go to Matthew 5. Okay, same thing, verse 27 through 32. You're discussing the Bible with somebody. They say, what's the topic of discussion in this part of Jesus' sermon, verse 27 through 32? What's your answer? Adultery. Look at verse 27. You shall not commit adultery. Look at verse 32. If you divorce your wife for some other reason than fornication, you commit adultery. And whoever marries her commits adultery. Now, there's two things that lead to adultery that he dealt with. One is lusting after a woman. That's verse 27, 28. The second is divorcing a woman, verse 31. Both lead to adultery. But he's not talking of, lust is not the topic of the section. Divorce is not the topic of the section. The topic of the section is adultery. And lust and divorce lead to adultery. Now, you don't have to have a Bible with a heading up there. You don't have to have a class book to tell you that. It's right there in the text. Where in this text does he talk about the protection of the innocent? It's not there. How do you get that into the text? Eisegesis, not exegesis. It's not there. Now, no, we have here on number two. If the protection of the innocent in cases where fornication is involved decides what is lawful, that's this position. Would the following situation justify the innocent in divorcing their mate and remarrying? Here's one. Let's suppose two people are going to get married and one of the parties, although they're going to go through the vows and go through the ceremony, they've already got their eyes on that other woman over there. Woman at work. They're going to get married on Saturday night, but we already have a plan next week to meet me and this woman at work. And we're going to commit fornication. So that was planned before the marriage. Now, they didn't commit it, but they planned it. Could the innocent party later remarry? So they planned the fornication. So if the fornication was unknown by the innocent party at the time of the divorce, so these two people get a divorce. One of them's committed fornication, but the other party don't know it. But they have their divorce. There's no marriage. 6 years later, they're talking to one of their friends and find out that person committed divorce before committed fornication before the divorce. Now, can they divorce them for fornication? No. Is that fair? It's not a matter of what you consider fair. It's a matter of what the text says. Look, in our look down here at point three, Jesus. If Jesus' legislation was to protect the innocent, would it justify the innocent divorcing and remarrying in the following situations? Two young people get married. Once they get married, the man starts abusing his wife verbally and physically. Calls her all kind of names, slaps her around. If Jesus' marriage laws were designed to protect the innocent, can she divorce him lawfully? If that was the case. But she can't. Let's forget the physical abuse. Let's just take the verbal abuse. Because physical abuse, somebody says, oh, yeah, well, she needs to get out of there. Well, let's take that off the table. Let's take the verbal abuse. Let's suppose he calls her names in front of the children, is derogatory all the time, day in and day out. Can she divorce him?
No.
Protection of the innocent, if that's the rule. What about, here's this sweet young girl, 18 years old. She gets married to this boy, 21 years old. Man, it just looks like he's a hunk. He's a great guy. But he starts drinking. And he gets drunk. And he won't work. There's no income for the family. He comes home, of course, what drunkenness does to a fella. She's only 19 years old now. Hey, if Jesus' marriage laws were the protection of the innocent, does she not have the right to divorce him? He's a drunken sot and won't work, won't take care of the family. What about immoral graphics? What if he starts looking at pornographic pictures? Can she divorce him then? So, we must beware of reasoning from consequences. In our first two classes, we talked about this. Back in Ezra chapter 10, look at back at Ezra chapter 10. In Ezra chapter 10, in verse 3, when they found out that their marriages, were they called marriages? Yes. Were they lawful?
No.
No. Were they marriages in God's eyes? Yes. But they were unlawful marriages in God's eyes. But anyway, that's back on that other point. But look at verse 3. Let us make a covenant with our God to put away all the wives and their children. Couldn't a Jew reason, well, I know we shouldn't marry those women, but for the protection of the innocent children, we can stay married. If not, why not? If that is the rule that provides an exception to the marriage law, why couldn't they stay with those women? And so, what happened with the children? I don't know. Terrible consequences. Put away the woman and the children. And you know, people want to blame God oftentimes. It's not God that got them in this mess. Satan got them in this mess. Blame Satan for blinding people's eyes. Blame themselves for not spending their time learning what God says when they could. It's not God that got them in the mess. What about in Matthew 22? This is the way the Sadducees argued. You believe in the resurrection, right? Yes. Okay, here's the situation. Verse 24, a man dies having no children. His brother next to kin to marry his wife, raise up offspring. Seven brothers, first married, died, and so forth. And so finally the woman died. Verse 28, in the resurrection, whose wife of the seven will they be? Your position has consequences you cannot deal with. And was that true? Did you have an answer for that argument? Would you have had? No. You'd have to say, you know, I don't know. But here's what I know. What did Jesus say? Where did he turn them to? Have you not read? God is not the God of the dead, but the living. He's the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Long after Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob's bodies were in the grave, if he's still their God, he still protects them. He still has a relationship with them. In other words, There's more to man than the body and the grave, and that's at the heart of the Sadducees' objection to the resurrection. They didn't believe man had a spirit that survived death. The resurrection is when the spirit reenters the body. The body without the spirit is dead, James 2:26. When the spirit enters the body, that's what the resurrection will be. Jesus will bring the saints with him. The dead will be raised. They'll enter their bodies. It'll be changed. It'll be an immortal body. What a day it will be. Let's talk about consequences. You know, this whole position here is, you know, the consequences of this just puts people, believing, teaching this, puts people in a terrible position. Do you believe baptism is necessary for the remission of sins? You do, don't you? Have you ever been talking to anybody about the Bible and they ask you, are you telling me my dear grandmother who went to church every time the doors were open, was always serving people, prayed every day, and because she was not baptized for remission of sins, she was not forgiven, she's lost? What's your answer?
Not my job.
But the consequences doesn't change the text. All you can do is say, look, here's what the Bible says. If you want to meet God on some of the bases, you go ahead. Same thing with marriage and divorce. But this leaves me in a bad position. I don't know, but here's what the text says. Now, if you want to face God, divorcing your mate because things were bad, you go ahead, but here's what the text says. What is God going to do with me? That's God's business. That's what the text says. And so, you know, you can just go case after case after case. All right? Ain't this fun? Now, you guys in this audience, I'm 77. I don't know if I'll be around till tomorrow. But if Wally decides to run this course through here again 5 years, I don't know if I'll be teaching it or not. You going to be ready? You going to be ready to answer these questions? If Josh is still here, he's going to have some questions for you. Which is good. I appreciate Josh. He wants to know what's right. Nothing wrong with asking questions. And so get prepared. You had a comment?
Just, I know you typed up these lessons, but under number 8 there, A, say, if someone says the reason that God put that in there is reason for this allowance is the, and they tell you the reason.
Is
you see where I'm reading that on the second line there?
The position, yes. What about it?
So just in general, when someone says the reason that's there, and they're telling you the reason, they're telling you what God's thoughts are, raises a flag.
Yeah, it does.
When you hear it,
now, if there's evidence in the text, okay. I just don't see the evidence in the text. And so just to say God put it there for this reason, now let's apply that to some other things. It doesn't work. And somebody over here, Linda, was that you going to say something?
Yes, but I was just going to ask, you know, when you brought up a physical abuse or drunkenness or, you know, beating the children, that kind of thing, divorce versus separating, getting out of there, out of harm's way, that would be different.
That would be different if it's not a severance of the relationship. You got to be careful there because you open the door to temptation. Yes, sir.
You were talking about consequences. I think one of the greatest examples of consequences is us deciding that he will collect the ark, he will help it fall, break it, ground. way his intentions were, he broke God's law and God healed him.
Good point.
That's a horrid thing. But the reality is, like, also like they never found the bigger, they meant no offense. But they died for what they did. Because they didn't treat God as old.
All right, so that's a good point. I want to get that on the recording. You know, Mark brought up the case of Uzzah. He's going to keep the ark from falling. Isn't that great? Shouldn't God just overlook that? Struck him dead. Now, maybe Uzzah's heart was corrupt. I don't know. But the point is, that's God's business. I just go, the text says, what did the text say about the ark? That's right, don't touch it. That's what the text says. Now, of course, they were already involved in that which was wrong, carrying the ark on a cart instead of carrying it through the rings on their shoulders. And once we get away from what God's plan is, we're just opening the door for more problems. Our time is up.